Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. Many Christians active in politics find themselves increasingly at odds with the culture. That's because the cross of Christ is inherently at odds with the culture. Today we begin a series on Christians, politics, and the cross. Stay with us. From the Moody Church in Chicago, this is Running to Win with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, whose clear teaching helps us make it across the finish line. Pastor Lutzer, in every election year, we wonder if getting involved in politics does any good. Give us a look ahead into this crucial series.
You know, Dave, throughout the years, I've read what many other Christians have said about politics. Some of them really emphasize politics. They think that America is going to be changed through politics. Others say, no, the only thing that matters is the gospel. Here's my view. I think that politics is very, very important. Should people get involved in the political system? Absolutely. That is our privilege. That is our duty. And we can have a tremendous impact. But at the same time, politics is not all important. The end of the day, as all of us know, it is the cross of Jesus Christ that we must stand for. It is the gospel that we must defend. And if America is to be changed, it will be changed through the gospel. So I think that we have an obligation to both realms. So as we open our Bibles today and begin a series on Christians, politics, and the cross, I hope that it will be helpful in helping all of us thinking through our role, especially during this political season. I'm sure I don't need to tell you that the cross has always clashed with popular culture. Come with me to the year AD 410. Rome is lying along the Tiber River, majestically asleep. When the citizens awake that morning, they have no idea that traitors are within their gates. Alaric the Goth, some of his soldiers overpowered the soldiers that were stationed at the Salarian Gate, and now they are within the walls of the city of Rome. They spend 3 days trashing the place. They take works of art, gold, silver, they load their carts, and 3 days later they leave. They did not burn Rome, they only destroyed it. They did not destroy entirely the city, but they wanted to humiliate it, and they did. And the question that the people and the citizens of Rome asked as they thought about it after the 3 days of horror were over was this: who is to blame? Who's to blame? And most of the citizens of Rome said that it is the Christians who are to blame. Their God is responsible for this. Rome is the city of Christendom, and God did not take care of his own city and his own people. In order to understand why the Christians were blamed, we need to go back nearly 100 years before that to the year 312. Constantine is coming to Rome and about to conquer it, and he sees the vision, "In this sign conquer," and he assumes that this is the Christian cross. Marches his men to the river, has them baptized as Christians, and puts the cross of Christ on their shields, and then goes to battle and wins. Thanks to his influential and famous mother Helena, who urged him to make Christianity the religion of the empire, Constantine does, and by the next generation, the whole city of Rome and the Roman Empire is, quote, Christianized. The pagans resented it. They resented it. Some of them said, "We are going to continue to worship our own gods," and they did. Others said, "If we have to worship the Christian God, at least we can take some of our pagan practices and we can continue to worship those too." And that's where you have a lot of paganism coming into Christianity.
Rome was pagan, polytheistic. They had a god. If you were to go on a journey, you were supposed to pray to that god. If you were to sell something, you were to pray to that god. Well, Christianity couldn't absorb all those different gods, but they accepted the idea that saints would now take over those responsibilities. And so many of the people who became Christians did so resentfully and only outwardly, and they were not genuinely converted. And now Rome had adopted this Christian god who did not defend them, and the pagans said, "Our god could have done a better job." In order for us to understand what really happened, let's put ourselves into the picture. Let us suppose that the religious right in America really got what they wanted: the criminalization of abortion, mandated school prayers. Let us suppose that we had a Christian Congress and a distinctively Christian president and a Supreme Court that acted in a Christianly way, and judges who gave Christian decisions. Let's suppose it were to happen, and in the middle of that, there would be an economic collapse. Banks would be closed, people would be laid off. What you would find is huge soup lines. Can you imagine what people would say? They would say, "You Christians, you're the ones that wanted to take over America, and the minute you take it over, here's this economic crisis. And you told us, you promised us that if only you could have, quote, America back, then things would be different and righteousness would abound and God would bless this place. And look at what has happened, and it's your fault." Can't you just hear it? Believe me, it would happen. Now, in order to defend the Christian God, and in order to give some perspective to what happened, there was a man by the name of Augustine, sometimes pronounced Augustine, and he wrote a book. And you heard me tell you several months ago, it is one of the great influential books of all time, and it's entitled The City of God, The City of God. Augustine said that really, in order to understand this, we must see that there are two cities. There is the city of man, and the city of man goes by man's rules. The city of man lives according to man's standards, and as far as the city of man is concerned, it is what men build. It is the art and the buildings and the paintings and the sculptures and the beauty of Rome. That is the city of man. But there is another city. It's called the city of God. The city of God is the God of the apostles. It is the God of the prophets. It is the God of all those who trust Christ, and it is His city. And we seek that city whose builder and foundation is God. And of course, because there are two cities, there are also two different kinds of citizens. There are those who became angry when Rome was trashed because this is their life. They are materialistic. They are filled with greed. Wealth and pomp and creature comforts represents all that they live for. And when that is taken away, they think that that which is most precious has been taken from them. But then there are Christians. And the Christians, they did not lose a whole lot when Rome was looted. And they didn't lose it because that's not where their heart is. They have treasure in heaven where moth and rust doth not corrupt and where thieves do not break through and steal. And there's nothing that Alaric and his hordes of barbarians can do to touch what is particularly precious to them. It is secure. I don't need to tell you today that in America there is increasing antagonism between the city of man and the city of God. They are in conflict. Today in America, the city of man is based on self-absorption, radical individualism, the idea that I have the right to create my own truth, to have my own standards, to make actually ex nihilo my own religion by combining whatever bits and pieces of other religions that I care to, or to believe nothing at all. Everyone is into their rights and into their freedoms. The city of man in America is based on human nature, the desires of human nature, doing your own thing, best summarized perhaps in the words of Woody Allen, "The heart wants what it wants, and whatever it wants, it should get." And then, of course, it is based on the lie of Eden that basically you shall be your own God. You shall be your God. What do we do, folks? What do we do? That is the question of the hour, and that is the purpose of the series of messages that I am beginning today. What does America need at this critical hour? What is our answer as we cast about reading the newspapers and seeing everything that we once counted dear being tossed aside? What is the answer? Well, I want you to know today that the Bible has an answer for us, as it always does, and I need to encourage you by reminding you that most of the epistles of the New Testament were written to little pockets of righteousness in the midst of a sea of paganism. The Christian church today is not facing any challenge that the church in the past has not faced. True Christianity has always been a minority. It has never usually been a friend to government, and government has never been a friend to it. There has always been this clash that we shall continue to talk about next week. And as a result of that, I want you to know that God is able to work in and through us. And yes, perhaps in His grace, things can still be turned around. But the question is, how and what are we to be doing? I want you to take your Bibles and turn to Philippians chapter 3 for just a moment. The Apostle Paul is sitting in jail in Rome, and he does not have a righteous ruler in Rome. As a matter of fact, did you know that as Paul was sitting there penning this epistle in Rome, sitting in jail, Nero was ruling? Nero, after all, was the man who had his own mother murdered. Nero was the one who, when Rome burned, blamed it on the Christians. And a number of years ago, my wife and I were in Rome, just outside of Nero's palace. We were actually in the palace too, the ruins, but outside the palace. And it is said that Christians lit his palace as they had pitch poured on them, and they were lighted, and there they burned. He was an evil, evil ruler. We've not seen the likes of him. We've not seen the likes of him in this country. And the Apostle Paul now is talking about the two different cities. And you'll notice in chapter 3, we pick it up at verse 18, he is speaking about the fact that our citizenship, our polis, that's the Greek word, our politics, verse 20, is in heaven. That's the city of God. Our politics is in heaven. And very briefly, five contrasts between the city of man and the city of God as outlined in these verses. First of all, notice that Paul says we walk in different directions. We walk in different directions. For many walk, of whom I often told you and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ. True believers walk toward the cross. We submit to the cross. The theme of my messages during these next weeks is the cross, which I'm going to explain because it is the centerpiece of God's agenda. And we love the cross. God forbid that we should glory except in the cross of Jesus Christ. But those who are enemies, they are not walking with the cross. Now, I want you to know that very probably Paul was not talking about the pagans here. He was talking about the Judaizers who were filled with legalism. Did you know that you don't have to be a pagan to be an enemy of the cross? All that you need to do is to distort the cross, add to the cross, think that the cross is not sufficient for salvation, and in other ways distort its message, and you become an enemy of the cross of Christ. Notice the contrast, though. The city of God, we love the cross. The city of man despises the cross. One of my messages is going to be entitled, What Men Think of the Cross and Why. Second contrast, we have different appetites. Whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite. Whatever desires I have in the body, I shall fulfill. Whatever I want to do, I will do. What seems good in my sight is sufficient for me. They know nothing about the fact that there is meat to eat that they know not of, and that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. They do not understand that because they are headed for destruction. Different appetites. Different appetites. And then I want you to notice that we have a different language. It says, whose glory is in their shame. And what a commentary on some of our trash talk shows today. People who should be embarrassed to let anybody know what they've done, and they're gloating about it on national television. Their glory is in their shame. They set their mind on earthly things, and that's all that they can talk about is those earthly things. And what about us? Well, we have a different language. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And we talk about the glories of Christ. We talk about his wonders. We love God. And we confess our love to him. And then notice another contrast. We live by different aspirations. Different aspirations. Our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. We want him to return because we love him. On this recent tour to Israel, somebody said, you know, I want Christ to return, but what about those who are not ready for his appearing? And that is a conflict indeed. We wonder about those, and therefore it is with mixed emotion that we refer to the return of Christ. But over and above all things, we desire his appearing because we are anxious to see him as he is. And I hope that if you are a part of the city of God, that that is your desire. That is your aspiration. That's not what the world is looking forward to. They're looking for one more opportunity to make more money so that they can live comfortably, so that they can live isolated from the traumas of life and somehow eke out just a little bit more pleasure in the years that they might happen to have. And then, of course, there's a different destination. You'll notice it says, who will transform the body of our humble estate into conformity with the body of his glory by the exertion of the power that he has even to subject all things to himself. And what about the end of those who know not God? Well, pick it up there in verse 19, whose end is destruction. Now, said Augustine, the city of man and the city of God, they interact. In eternity past, there was only the city of God. Because of the fall of man, now there is the city of God and the city of man, and we are citizens of both realms. And in the future, they shall be separated again forever, one to everlasting destruction and the other to everlasting bliss. But the challenge before you and me is this present moment. It is their interaction. And the question that is before us is, how shall the city of God live in the midst of the city of man? What is our agenda at this very critical moment of American history? That's the question before us. What do we do? People are asking. Christians are asking. What is God's answer? Well, do we withdraw? After the Scopes trial in America, fundamentalism tended to withdraw from culture. It had its Bible studies. It preached its sermons, largely, though, to itself. There was really no bridge to culture because the world was deemed to be evil, and the best way that you separate yourself from the world is to be isolated from it. Well, that does not seem to be the problem today. There's another extreme that people are falling into, and that is to say, let's do this. Let's capture the city of man. Let's take it over. Let's elect a Congress that is distinctively Christian. Let us elect a president who is distinctively Christian. Let us make sure that our judges of the land become Christian. And then we will be in charge, and you will see the changes that will be made, and America will be great again. Maybe if we can capture the city of man, we can turn it into a paradise. Well, I want you to know today that history does not bear out the possibility of that being successful.
Well, my friend, today, don't interpret my words as saying that politics isn't important. But the simple fact is that even if we were to take over the whole political system, what we would find is tremendous opposition. And what we must do is to infiltrate the political system, but at the same time, we always need to recognize that it is the message of the cross that transforms people. By the way, did you know that the predicament that we are in is not unusual? Christians have always struggled between the relationship of the flag and the cross, whatever country they may belong to. I've written a book entitled Christians, Politics, and the Cross. Christians, Politics, and the Cross. I really do think that it will help all of us think through the relationship of the flag and the cross. Here's what you do for a gift of any amount, it can be yours. You go to rtwoffer.com, rtwoffer.com, or you can call us at 1-888-218-9337. I'll give you that information again in just a moment. But we all need to be reminded of the fact that we have a message, and the best news that people will ever hear will never come from Washington. It'll come from the lips and the lives of believers who represent Jesus Christ. Christians, Politics, and the Cross can be yours for a gift of any amount. Here's what you do. Go to rtwoffer.com, rtwoffer.com, or you can call us at 1-888-218-9337. And can I thank you in advance for helping us? The ministry of Running to Win is heard throughout many countries of the world because of people just like you.
Time now for another chance for you to ask Pastor Lutzer a question you may have about the Bible or the Christian life. Issues of marriage have prompted a listener named Charles to email us these questions, Dr. Lutzer. He asks, after divorce, is remarriage allowed? And what place do the remarried have in the church? Does it matter if they come to Christ after their divorce rather than if they had been divorced as Christians? And can they be restored to fellowship?
Well, thanks so much for your email, Charles. And of course, you're asking some very, very interesting and far-flung questions. But very simply, I'm going to begin with your middle question. No, it really doesn't make any difference whether you accepted Jesus Christ or not in relation to the marriage bond. You know, the question of whether or not the bond is broken, I don't think has a whole lot to do with whether or not you were a Christian when you married or whether you became a Christian afterwards. In answer to your other question, is divorce allowed? Well, I believe it is under certain conditions, certainly when there has been prolonged adultery, and when one partner remarries, I think the other is free to remarry, but you'd better check with your pastor because not everybody is agreed on that. But finally, you ask the question, can somebody who is divorced or has been divorced, can they be restored to fellowship? Yes, of course they can be. Forgiveness is available for divorce as it is for other sins, but we have to distinguish here between fellowship and also the question of ministry. Because while you may be restored to ministry, you may not be able to have certain functions or roles within the church. For example, here at the Moody Church, we have an informal rule that someone who's been divorced can't be on the elder board. Other churches have different policies, so you have to stick with that church. But always remember that yes, God is a God of new beginnings. And so if you're the one to whom this question applies, what you need to do is to assess the past, receive forgiveness in those areas where forgiveness is needed, and move on.
Some wise words of counsel from Dr. Erwin Lutzer. Thank you, Pastor Lutzer. If you'd like to hear your question answered, go to our website at rtwoffer.com and click on Ask Pastor Lutzer. Or call us at 1-888-218-9337. That's 1-888-218-9337. You can write to us at Running to Win, 1635 North LaSalle Boulevard, Chicago, Illinois, 60614. The cross of Christ is inherently in conflict with our culture, especially when the media flaunts immorality as normal. Politicians vie for position on issues the Bible settled long ago. Thankfully, the cross can do what politics can't. Next time on Running to Win, Dr. Lutzer will continue listing the conflicts between what he's calling the city of man and the city of God. Plan to join us for more of the clash of cross and culture. Thanks for listening. For Dr. Erwin Lutzer, this is Dave McAllister. Running to Win is sponsored by the Moody Church.